From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. In December 2015, representatives of the international community came together to adopt the Paris Agreement, a legally binding global treaty regarding climate change. The goal of the agreement was to limit global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably no more than 1.5 degrees, above pre-industrial temperature levels between 1850 and 1900. According to the UN Climate Change webpage, the past 7 years were the warmest on record. There is nearly a 50-50 chance that the annual mean temperature will temporarily hit 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average for at least 1 year in the next 5 years. The UN goes on to say that as global warming increases, certain tipping points in the climate system cannot be ruled out. A recent study goes further by suggesting that breaching the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit could trigger a series of those tipping points that may lead to irreversible changes in our climate system. My guest for today's program is David McKay. He's the lead author of that study. From his website bio, David is a research consultant and science communicator at GeoResilience Analytics based in Brighton, England, a visiting fellow at the University of Exeter's Global Systems Institute, and an associate researcher at Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden. David joins me today to talk about these climate tipping points and the consequences of setting them off. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
David, as you know, one of the goals of the 2015 Paris Agreement includes efforts to limit the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial temperature average. I'm curious, how was that 1.5 degree number determined?
So originally, the target in climate negotiations within these big United Nations talks was 2 degrees. That's the target that countries around the world were aiming to limit warming to. But there was a lot of criticism of that number because 2 degrees, it was argued by some of the small island developing states, they said that 2 degrees would be too much, that would cause their nations to lose all their land, especially in the sort of smaller island states. So 1.5 degrees became the new target that the Paris Agreement was aiming for, and they wanted to get it as far below as 2 degrees as possible, trying to get to 1.5 degrees. So that's where that number initially came from.
When we're talking about the temperatures, the global temperatures, we're talking about surface and ocean global temperatures. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how they play together to come up with an overall figure?
Yeah, so when we're talking about global warming and setting targets and trying to limit warming to 1.5, we're talking about the global average surface temperature. And this includes both the temperature over the land and over the seas as well, the ocean. But there is actually a bit of a difference between those two areas. The land is heating up more than the sea because the sea is just kind of it's a large mass. It takes a lot of energy to heat it up. Whereas the land is covered by soil that's thinner than the sea. So it takes a lot less time for that to heat up and cool down overnight and over time as well. When we're talking about global warming, the number we're talking about is that average across all of the land and the sea. But there will be regional differences and the difference between the land and the sea as well.
I was looking at the statistics as far as global temperatures from as long as it was recorded. And I noticed that post-industrial revolution temperatures started rising. But I also noticed several years where the temperatures actually dropped somewhat. Mm. And even as recently as I think the mid-70s, there were a couple of years, I think it was 74 and 76, when the temperatures went back down maybe, you know, a little bit from the average that was starting to establish itself. Can you explain why we have those little bit of differences in the global temperature?
Yes. So over time, we do get variability in the climate system. Global average temperatures don't stay still. There is some kind of, sometimes it'll be a little bit higher and sometimes it will be a little bit lower. And in particular, we see global warming starting to pick up from the late 19th century. Coming into the 1900s, it starts increasing. But there's actually a bit of a plateau and a dip, as you say, after the Second World War. That's partially from this natural variability in the climate, but also there's an extra bit in there that we're also emitting other things apart from just greenhouse gases. We're emitting things like carbon dioxide and methane, which trap heat and cause global warming. But we're also emitting something that we call aerosols, and that's actually just tiny little particles, effectively kind of like dust. And that comes from things like burning coal, burning wood, and it goes into the atmosphere, and it actually starts reflecting some sunlight as well. So as well as global warming, we actually cause a certain amount of global dimming. Overall, we do more warming than dimming, which is why we see temperatures increasing over the past 100 years. But in some time periods, especially after the Second World War, there was actually quite a lot of dimming going on because there was an awful lot of new industry expansion going on in the mid-20th century that put up a lot more of these cooling aerosol particles. But then in the 70s, there were some new laws came in, especially in Europe and America, that cleaned up some of these things, the clean air laws, and actually reduced some of this aerosol pollution, which helped clean up the air. That meant it was better to breathe, improve people's health, but it actually slightly unmasked some of that warming it was hiding, which meant that temperatures could carry on rising again towards now.
Yeah, I did notice from the 1980s through now that there was a definite increase in temperatures and very little changes in the global temperatures per year. Based on current data and accepted modeling, when is it predicted, or has it even been predicted, when Earth would meet and then surpass that 1.5 Celsius limit?
Yeah, so at the moment, we're around about 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial. And by what we mean by pre-industrial, when we're talking about it in climate science, we just use an average of the late 19th century, kind of 1850 to 1900, as kind of a baseline to measure warming from. So we're about 1.2 degrees or so now. But the projection is that sometime in the 2030s, so sometime in a decade, maybe a bit more, we will hit that 1.5 degree limit for multiple years. There's a possibility that 1 or 2 years between now and then might just about get to 1.5 degrees. But the point at which the kind of the longer term average hits 1.5 degrees and we're definitely at that level will come some point in the 2030s. And then we'll probably, on current trajectories, get to 2 degrees. So that's kind of the less ambitious Paris Agreement aim. We'll get to that around about the middle of the century, sometime in the 2050s, probably, on our current rate.
Now, you said something in your last answer there that I wanted to ask you about. I was looking at a website called The Conversation, and I understand that when it comes to determine that the Earth has reached its 1.5 degree warming since the pre-industrial era, it will not be made after just 1 year. So in other words, if we hit 1.5 1 year, they're not going to necessarily look at that as reaching that threshold or for any even single location. That will be, how will that mark be determined? In other words, how many years would have to go by being at 1.5 degrees or more? Would that then be established as meeting and surpassing the threshold?
Yeah, so there's not a specific number of years here, because there's different ways of calculating what the current global warming actually is. So some people will say it's maybe, if you take a longer average, maybe we're closer to 1.1 right now. But I have some colleagues who will say actually they think we're closer to 1.3. And that's part of this problem around climate science, is that it is still a developing area. We still have some uncertainty even about exactly how much warming is happening right now. But I would say that if warming went to 1.5 degrees for, say, 5 or more years, then that would pretty much be, we'd be pretty certain that that's where current global warming would be sitting. There's always this between every year, there is some amount of variability because things like El Nino and La Nina pattern in the Pacific Ocean, that can really affect what the year's temperature will be for the whole world. But yes, after a few years, after say 5 years of hitting 1.5 degrees, we can be pretty certain that that's where the Earth is now kind of reaching.
A lot of studies have been conducted over the years concerning global warming and climate change. And although we're keeping an eye on the global temperature so that it doesn't surpass 1.5 degrees, some of the scientists are saying that we're already past a point of no return and that there's no way we can avoid reaching and exceeding that mark. What are your thoughts, David?
So in the last IPCC assessment, they actually were looking a bit about future trajectories. And they did assess that even in their most optimistic scenario, we will reach 1.5 degrees. That optimistic scenario is that we managed to level off at 1.5. But that was their most optimistic scenario. And their more, slightly more realistic scenarios involved something called overshoot, that maybe we would go to 1.6 or 1.7 before emissions managed to get to zero or net zero. And after that point, maybe we'd start to be able to pull some carbon dioxide out of the air and cause a little bit of cooling. So we get this, maybe we'd be able to get down to 1.5 degrees again by the end of the century. So that's considered a bit more realistic, but also that depends on technologies to remove carbon dioxide from the air that we haven't really built at scale yet. So they're kind of uncertain.
David, I'm taking from what you're saying is that the concentration is on carbon dioxide itself, because you mentioned methane and you mentioned aerosols as well. So carbon dioxide is the main driver of the warming that we're experiencing.
Exactly. Yeah. Carbon dioxide is the key driver of warming. There's quite a bit from methane as well, but carbon dioxide really is a key. And the main source of that carbon dioxide, and also of a lot of the methane as well, is the burning of fossil fuels. So of coal, of oil and gas, that really is the main thing that's driving it.
Now, a new study you led, exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming, could trigger multiple climate tipping points. It was recently published in the journal Science, and I was quite impressed with the study. I guess you mapped out 9 policy-relevant tipping elements and their climate tipping points, and I understand that these tipping points were originally identified in 2008. Now, what are your tipping points and tipping elements?
So first of all, let's lay out what a climate tipping point actually is. In our study, we take a definition. We were quite specific with it because it varies across scientific papers and in the media. And we say that a climate tipping point is when change in a part of the climate system, so something like an ice sheet, a rainforest, an ocean current, when change in that part of the climate system becomes self-sustaining beyond some warming threshold. By self-sustaining, we mean that change in that thing will keep on going even if we were to take some of the warming that caused it away. So, for example, the Greenland ice sheet is one of our tipping elements. And by tipping element, we mean part of the climate system that can experience this sort of tipping point dynamic. So the Greenland ice sheet, we say that beyond 1.5 degrees of warming could experience a tipping point where it will become inevitable, it will collapse. We would have committed to the loss of the Greenland ice sheet. And that's because there are amplifying feedbacks that keep the melt going. Even if we were to bring warming back underneath 1.5 degrees, we could reverse global warming to some extent, and the collapse of the Greenland ice sheet would keep on going. And that's the key thing about a tipping point. And we identify a number of these across the climate system. So we identify, as you say, 9 core global tipping points that really affect the state of the whole planet. But we also identify a number of extra ones, 7 regional impact tipping elements, we call them. And these are things that if they were tipped, they don't quite change the state of the whole planet to the same extent, but they would still impact millions of people. So there are things like the dieback of coral reefs in there, or the loss of mountain glaciers that provide drinking water for people. Whereas some of the core global elements include things like the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, which together hold something like 10 meters worth of sea level rise in them if they were to collapse over thousands of years. So these are really big things that would affect millions of people around the world if they were to tip, and it becomes more likely the further we go above 1.5 degrees.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other websites. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs, or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. Our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. Now, let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. A recent study suggests that breaching the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit above pre-industrial temperature levels could trigger a series of tipping points that may lead to irreversible changes to our climate system. My guest for today's program is David McKay, lead author of the study. From his website bio, David is a research consultant and science communicator at GeoResilience Analytics based in Brighton, England, a GSI visiting fellow at the University of Exeter's Global Systems Institute, and an associate researcher at Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden. Today, we're talking about these climate tipping points and the consequences of setting them off. David, studies concerning the impact of the escalating melting of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets have been in the news recently. What is the importance of these two ice sheets? How do they affect climate? And what would be the effects of their collapse or further severe melting?
Yeah, so I just mentioned that together, the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets contain up to 10 meters or over 10 meters of potential sea level rise. So if their tipping points were crossed, over the coming hundreds to thousands of years, they would irreversibly collapse. And that means they would release all the water they currently store in the ice, add that to sea level, and sea level would just consistently go up more and more. And more than 10 meters of sea level rise would be enough to completely redraw the Earth's maps. All of the global coastlines would look different. And there would be major cities around the world, like London or Shanghai or Bangkok, that would be potentially have to move because of this sea level change. It's worth saying that it would take a long time. We're talking about probably thousands of years, but it's still a huge burden to place on future generations, our descendants, to leave them such a radically changed planet. There are some tipping points we identify around 1.5 degrees that would have more immediate impacts, though. So I mentioned coral reefs dying off because of the marine heat waves bleaching the corals. If they were to collapse the ecosystems there, something like 500 million people around the world depend on coral reefs for their livelihoods, for things like fisheries, but also indirectly through coastal protection. Coral reefs help to protect the coastlines that lie behind them. We also identify abrupt permafrost fall in the kind of northern circumarctic area as being something that could happen beyond 1.5 degrees as well. This is when you kind of get these huge craters and lakes and stuff forming in these areas, and they accelerate the thawing out of the permafrost as it warms up. And this both releases a lot of extra greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, so it amplifies warming even further, but it also causes a huge amount of disruption in those areas. It ruins kind of like roads and infrastructure and buildings and the livelihoods of indigenous peoples that live around the Arctic. So those are some of the key impacts there.
I also understand that with the melting of the permafrost, some viruses and bacteria that have been remaining dormant for all these years may be released as well.
Yeah, so there have been some outbreaks of things like anthrax in sort of localized areas because, yeah, there are corpses that are thawing out up there, coming out of the permafrost that are carrying these things. To be honest, though, the things I'm most worried about with permafrost thaw is that it releases extra carbon dioxide, extra methane. We estimate it over the course of centuries, it boosts the amount of global warming we'll see by something like 5 to 10%, which is enough to make it really difficult to hit our targets. But also it's worth saying it's not enough to say that's a runaway situation. We're still causing most of the warming, but nature could start to add more on top of that the further we go. That's the main thing with the permafrost thaw that is worrying.
You were talking about the melting of the permafrost once we met or exceeded the 1.5 degree threshold. Do you know the status of the permafrost now? I mean, are we seeing widespread melting?
So we're definitely seeing widespread gradual thaw. That is definitely being observed now. And we are seeing localized abrupt thaw. So in this study, we sort of split it between two different types of permafrost decay. So gradual thaw is where it kind of is thawing gradually from the top, like you would do in a microwave oven or similar. Whereas abrupt thaw is when you get these big, what we would call in geology, erosional features. So you get these huge craters and lakes and slopes that collapse and slump and erosional gullies. It's kind of all these kind of, these features in the landscape that get cut through some of this deeper permafrost and start releasing some of the carbon that's buried deeper in this stuff. Because permafrost is basically just, it's permanently frozen ground. It contains all the organic carbon that comes from like leaf litter and plants that die at the surface. Instead of rotting, they just get frozen into the soil. But when they fall, when warming causes all that, all the ice there to melt, then they become available to rot down at last, and that releases all this carbon. And that's a lot easier to do if all these abrupt fall features are kind of cutting up the landscape. And what we're saying is that, yes, we're seeing some of that localized now, but by the time you get to 1.5 degrees, all those type of features become much more widespread across all of the northern zones, and that can really accelerate that process.
We had mentioned the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctica ice sheet, but what about the Arctic? Scientists have known for years that the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet. I guess it's a phenomenon called Arctic amplification, and temperatures there in the Arctic are rising about 2 to 3 times the global average rate. What kind of impact will this have on global temperatures and global climate?
Yeah, so in this study, we look at Arctic sea ice, because that's one of the key reasons why that Arctic amplification is happening. So if you imagine white, very bright sea ice in the northern areas in the Arctic Ocean, when there's sea ice, actually that reflects a lot of the sun's energy back into space as high albedo is how we call it. But as we're warming up the planet, that sea ice area is getting less, in particular during the warm summer months in the Arctic Ocean. The less sea ice there is, the less of that solar energy is being reflected back into space. That means that actually the water around the ice is warming up faster than it would do otherwise. And that amplifies it. It causes more warming, that melts more of the sea ice, which means that more energy can stay in the ocean and it goes on in the cycle. So that's one of the reasons why the Arctic is warming up so much. As you say, 2 to 3 times. Actually, in some areas, it's around 4 times as fast as the rest of the planet. It's really quite impressive. But something we do in this study is that we actually don't say that the Arctic summer sea ice is the tipping point. Because as far as we can tell from looking at all the scientific studies published over the past 15 years, is that there doesn't seem to be some warming level beyond which that becomes a self-sustaining change, our core definition of what we're climate tipping point is. It's always depending on what the current level of global warming is, and it doesn't run away to itself. But what we do find is that the Arctic winter sea ice, so that in the middle of the winter, there's sea ice everywhere, even now, still in the Arctic. But at some point, even that becomes under threat under really high warming scenarios. And in some of the climate models, that really does collapse quite sharply. And that suggests that there is a tipping point for the Arctic winter sea ice. But yes, in the meantime, even if there isn't a tipping point for summer sea ice, the Arctic is still warming up a huge amount. And that obviously affects things like the permafrost nearby and the Greenland ice sheet. It has this knock-on impact on all these other tipping elements we've been talking about.
Looking at a graphic that you included in your study, it illustrates pretty much what these climate tipping elements are. And you also have it broken down to, should we go under 2 degrees Celsius, between 2 and 4 degrees Celsius, and what would happen if the global temperature went beyond 4 degrees Celsius. Now, one thing I noticed that I know affects climate, if not weather, is the Labrador Sea Subpolar Gyre.
Yeah,
can
so
you
this
explain
is,
that, please?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here to do with ocean circulation, which we haven't talked about much yet. So people have been worried about something, tipping point called the, or tipping element called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which we can just call the overturning circulation for short. There is a warm water current that flows up the Atlantic from south to north along the surface. When it gets to around Greenland, it starts to cool down. It starts to get denser and it starts to sink. And then it sinks to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean and flows back the other way. And this acts as a kind of like a pump for the global ocean. But the trouble is that as temperatures are warming up in the Arctic, as we've talked about, and as Greenland is starting to melt and is releasing a lot of meltwater, which is quite sort of fresh and light, it's less dense. That water and that warming in the North Atlantic actually starts to disrupt the sinking of water and this ocean pumping, what we call the overturning circulation. Now, the main part of that is described as the AMOC. That is kind of one of the bigger of those circulations that could be disrupted. And we assess that as being a quite high warming level, something like 4 degrees as at risk. But what we actually do in this study is that we've separated out kind of a branch of that circulation, which goes into, it's called the Labrador and the Erminger Seas in the more northwest of the Atlantic Ocean. So kind of around about between Canada and Greenland, that sort of area. From the last few rounds of IPCC models and modeling, they found that in quite a lot of models, you can get this part of the ocean circulation shutting down a lot sooner than the rest of the Atlantic overturning circulation. And that could have really quite significant impacts. So it would cause major cooling around the North Atlantic. So we're talking kind of like minus 10 degrees locally, minus 4 degrees more kind of regionally. That would disrupt weather patterns both in North America and in Europe. It would shift things like the jet stream. It would change where storms and rainfall happens. But it would even actually have an impact on the tropics as well, because it changes where heat in the world is being transported to. And it ends up actually shifting where monsoons happen. So places that currently have monsoons might not see them as much anymore. They might get weaker or they move. And places that are currently dry might get more rain instead. So in particular, this could affect West African coasts down there. And it could affect places like the Sahel. So that's the region below the Sahara Desert. That's kind of grassland dominated at the moment. But those could be really affected if this ocean circulation collapses and moves around where monsoons are happening in the world.
Can you please draw some probable or possible scenarios regarding how our lives will be affected by a beyond 1.5, beyond 2 degrees? What are we looking at? How is it going to impact human life on Earth?
Beyond 2 degrees certainly would look like a really different planet. So there was a special report from the IPCC a few years ago that looked at the differences between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And that seems like not much of a difference. You know, it's only half a degree Celsius difference. But there's an acceleration of impacts between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And even actually now, having gone beyond 1 degree, we've seen a lot of climate impacts already worsening, and climate extremes we really weren't expecting to see this soon already happening now. So by the time you get to 2 degrees, we really are looking at a different planet with huge amounts of ecosystems moving. So where you might expect currently there being a rainforest, it might shift to being towards a more kind of savanna steppe-like state. Big agricultural regions would be seeing drop-offs in productivity. We wouldn't see it straight away, but that level of temperature would result in sea level rises accelerating. So that would start affecting some of the major cities near the coasts and farmland near the coastlines, where there's already salt water coming in and making the land less productive. And we, beyond 2 degrees, we're also doing things like we're committing mountain glaciers to being lost in most regions. So we might see something called peak water, where the water supply, for example, coming out of the Himalayas and the Andes and mountains in Africa, those water supplies might start reducing from those glaciers, which will have impact on huge amounts of people. And we've already mentioned coral reefs as well. Mm-hmm. By 2 degrees, it's extremely likely that the vast majority of coral reefs ecosystems will have collapsed, taking with it all those fisheries that so many millions of people depend on. So yes, I would say beyond 1.5 degrees, and especially beyond 2 degrees, we're starting to see a radically different planet, and one that will be far harder for us to live on and far harder for us to actually adapt to those impacts. The IPCC, in one of the reports recently, assessed that beyond 2 degrees, it just gets really difficult to actually adapt to that, whereas at 1.5 degrees, we can learn to live with it to some extent.
I've heard some people draw even more dire consequences of the temperature being above 2 degrees, calling major parts of Earth being uninhabitable.
So this is tapping into this idea that there's something called wet bulb temperature, which is a combination of temperature, but also humidity. Because if it's too humid outside, you can't actually sweat enough in order to get rid of the heat in your body. And so there is this sort of limit beyond which human bodies just cannot function anymore. At the moment, it doesn't really happen that often. It happened in the very narrow band in the tropics. At some points of the year at the moment, it's occasionally happening. But beyond 2 degrees, we're getting to the point where it will be happening in wider and wider areas for more and more of the year. And that's okay if you live in a rich area with lots of air conditioning and infrastructure and facilities that can help with that. But a lot of people in the tropics and the subtropics just don't have that. And yes, the further warming goes beyond 2 degrees, the more you're getting into places like in equatorial Africa and in Amazonia and in South Asia as well, in Southeast Asia. Those areas are going to be struggling more and more to deal with some of these climate impacts. And they will be heading towards maybe not necessarily uninhabitable, but certainly incredibly inhospitable compared to what they are now.
Dr. David Armstrong McKay, I want to thank you so much for taking time to join us for today's program and for sharing your insights and what you've learned in your new study. Thank you so much again.
Thank you for having me.
That was David McKay, a research consultant and science communicator at Geo Resilience Analytics based in Brighton, England, a GSI visiting fellow at the University of Exeter's Global Systems Institute, and an associate researcher at Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks for listening today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.